Welcome to Footsteps of the Fallen, a Great War podcast with me, battlefield researcher, historian and writer, Matt Dixon. For over 35 years, I've been visiting the cemeteries, memorials and battlefields of the First World War. And in this series of podcasts, I'd like to take you on a journey through France, Belgium and further afield and tell you the stories of some of the places I've visited and the stories of the men who lie as the dead of the Great War. So pack up your kit bag, pour yourself a cuppa, and join me as we walk the well-trodden paths on the battlefields, following in the footsteps of the fallen. It's a pleasure to have your company. So welcome to this latest episode of Footsteps of the Fallen. And you join us today on a significant episode because this is not only the final episode of season 6 of the podcast, but it's also the 150th podcast since we began producing it 3.5 years ago. And when I began the podcast back in October of 2020, I have to be honest, I didn't really know whether it was something that I was really going to get into or not. And when I listen back, as I occasionally do, to some of the early episodes, I sort of cringe really at how bad the recording and the editing was. But I suppose, like all things, you learn as you go along, and these things kind of improve organically. And we've got to a stage now where I'm most of the time I'm pretty happy with the standard of the audio recording and the editing that you as podcast listeners get to hear with each episode. And when you are recording, the challenge always is that unless you can find a room in your house that has no echo, or you're fortunate enough to have a fully functional recording studio in your house, it can really be quite challenging, I think, to get a sound quality as good as one might like, no matter how good one's microphone is. And despite this, producing this podcast is something that I enjoy doing tremendously. I'll be honest, it can sometimes be a bit of a pain in the bum to record it on a weekly basis, but it has got to the stage that it's something that I actually look forward to doing, and I really enjoy it. And I think the wonderful thing about podcasting on a subject as immense as the Great War is that you're never going to run out of topics to talk about. And I remember reading an article a few years ago about starting a podcast, and I remember that the podcast said is that you need to find that one subject in life that is your absolute passion. It's the one thing that you could talk or bore a stranger with for hours on end, the one thing that you think about every single day without fail. And then when you've found that subject, then you have the basis for a podcast. And for me, recording this podcast, the most important thing is to provide you, the listeners, with something enjoyable and interesting to listen to. And I think what the ethos of it, or the essence of the podcast, is to take familiar places and provide unfamiliar information about them. And it's also very, very important to tell the personal stories that lie behind the names on the headstones and the memorials. But above all, I think for me, the overriding aim of this podcast has always been to have the opportunity to share my passion for the First World War with you, the listeners. And I always feel that if one single person who listens to the podcast has the opportunity to say, gosh, I never knew that, or oh, that's interesting, I wasn't aware of that, or I didn't understand that about something that they've heard in the podcast, then I think that's by far and away the greatest compliment that any podcaster can receive. As my good friend Paul Reed has said on more than one occasion, it really is at the moment a golden age for World War One podcasts. And I think the average podcast listener now has so much choice available to them. It's indicative, really, I think, not only of the just a huge amount of material that the Great War produces for people to be able to talk about, but it's also, I think, reflective of the popularity of podcasts themselves. There was a conversation actually last week on social media where someone was asking the question about whether there was too many podcasts on the First World War or military history. And as someone who produces a First World War podcast, my answer would be absolutely no, because I think what it does is it gives the listener choice. And the great thing about podcasts, there are many podcasts that I've listened to, and you listen to one episode and decide, actually, it's really not for me, and you just don't listen again. But there is, to say, such a huge variety of sources and podcasts and styles and tales to tell. It really is, I think Paul is right, it really is a golden age for the podcast. And there are some absolutely tremendous First World War podcasts out there. And I always recommend to anyone Paul's The Old Front Line, which I think really sets the benchmark and the standard for which all First World War podcasts should aim to. But also the podcasts of people like Terry Wenham and Mike Cunha and Spencer Jones. There are so many out there, and it's a pleasure to play a small part in contributing towards the amount of material that's out there and available for podcast listeners. But what I think is really interesting is how all of the podcasts that are produced on the First World War all have their own sort of style and their own kind of interpretation and delivery of history. And something I think that's very important to stress is that I certainly have never felt that there's any rivalry or sort of one-upmanship with any Great War podcasters that I know of. It's a very collaborative process. And I think all of the podcasts that are produced, I think they all complement each other. And perhaps most excitingly is I think we all bring something very different to the podcast table for listeners. And it's an incredibly exciting thing to be part of. And as I said, we've got to 150 episodes. And where does that leave us? Well, as podcasters, and I think particularly as a podcast, when you're first starting out, it's very, very easy to become fixated on download numbers. But I think as you go forward and you progress, you begin to understand really that downloads are just one element of how to measure, if you want to say, kind of the success of a podcast. I mean, the download numbers are clearly a very useful tool, but the statistics can on occasions be slightly misleading. And I've got to be honest now that I've been doing this, say, for 3.5 years, and it's very rare that I actually check the cumulative download numbers for the podcast. And the reason really is because the podcast has sort of grown into this organism that I know when it's released that I can pretty much now work out the number of downloads that it will receive in the first kind of 12 hours, and then the first 24 hours, and then really sort of the first week, and pretty much also to the first month, because it's settled into this sort of comfortable pattern of release, and there's a kind of hard core fan base, I suppose, if that's the right word to say, of people who will download the podcast week in, week out. But because this is a slightly significant episode, I did do a little bit of a deep dive into some of the podcast statistics since it began. And I have to say that I was actually quite surprised by what I discovered when I started looking at some of the numbers. And what do the numbers tell us? Well, the podcast currently has over 630,000 downloads, which is not including this episode. And I was looking through the stats, and according to the World Health Organization, there are 195 countries on planet Earth. And I've found that the podcast has actually been downloaded in 147 different countries and 6,691 different towns and cities across the globe. And it's quite remarkable, really, that an amateur sitting in a small village in Berkshire is able to sort of reach out to such a global audience. And I think that's the wonderful thing about podcasting, is it is so open, and the internet has enabled like this huge spread around the globe for people who produce podcasts. I was quite shocked, actually, when I was doing the research into podcasting statistics, that 90% of all podcasts that begin don't actually make it past 1 year before they get what's called pod fade, or sort of the spark goes out. So I think really to still be here 3.5 years after we began is something to be quite chuffed about, really. And the other remarkable thing as well is that from the research, where you look at the average number of weekly downloads for podcasts in the first week that a podcast is released, it puts Footsteps of the Fallen in the top 3% of all podcasts globally, again, which is just a quite remarkable figure. And so I think something that I'm very proud of. And when I looked back at the episodes that we've produced, there's over 170 hours of content that we've released since we began. And what I did is I worked out, and this is a level of geekery which is quite impressive even by my own normal standards, that if you were able to drive at 80 miles an hour at a constant speed, and of course ignoring borders and war zones and that sort of thing, you could actually drive from London to Istanbul without getting through the entire back catalogue. Interesting statistic. And so I was really sort of quite surprised at that. For some reason, and I don't really know why, Saturday is always the day of the week that has the fewest number of downloads. And I suspect that's probably because most people are listening to Paul Reed's latest episode of The Old Frontline. I don't know, but it is true throughout the life of the podcast that Saturday is always the weakest day. So when I look back through all of the episodes that have been published, which are the ones that really stand out to me? Well, the top three podcasts in terms of the number of downloads on the day of release are actually all episodes of Trench Talks, where we sit and have conversation with somebody about a topic of the First World War. And Alexandre Leon in conversation about Jules the Poilu was the most downloaded podcast in a single day since we began. And actually, it's the most downloaded podcast overall to date of all 150 so far. In terms of the downloads on the day of release, my conversation with Tom Isett about the Italian front was the second most downloaded podcast on the day of release, but it was a very close run thing. And in fact, Alex only held on to his crown by a mere 2 downloads. The Christmas episode that we released last Christmas 2023, where we were talking with Professor Peter Doyle, was another hugely popular episode. And I suspect that that episode had people rummaging through cupboards and drawers to see if there was a Princess Mary tin lying somewhere. When we look at, I suppose one would say, the sort of the fighty stuff of the First World War, the podcasts that we've done on Neuve Chapelle, the fighting at High Wood, the Birdcage at Plug Street, and the podcast on Sanctuary Wood, they all proved to be incredibly popular episodes. And I always try to perhaps cover some topics that are a bit beyond the normal sphere of battles and that kind of thing. And we've looked at things including espionage and the army, postal service, concert parties, alcohol. That was actually quite a popular podcast. It maybe says something about my podcast listeners. I don't know. But I think the episode that probably got the most attention in terms of feedback and emails and social media engagements and that sort of thing was the episodes we did about farming the front, where we looked at the incredible story of how the fields of France were turned into these massive military farms to provide food for the front. And I think it does go to show that there is much more to the military history of the First World War than big battles and lots of things that kind of go bang. I was asked recently what is my favourite type of podcast of the various ones that we've produced. And whilst every episode of Trench Talk is fascinating and really highly enjoyable to record in every sense, my personal favourite podcasts are the Journey Through a Cemetery episodes, where we pick a particular cemetery and tell the personal stories of many of the men who lie buried within. And it is the personal stories that really appeal to me. And this is a format that I really look forward to continuing with as we head into season 7 of the podcast. But despite all of this, there is, of course, one massively important element of the podcast that I haven't yet mentioned, and that is, of course, you, the podcast listeners. Because without any of you, there really wouldn't be a point in producing a podcast at all. And whether you are a new listener, or you've listened to the podcast from the very beginning, or you're somewhere between the two, I thank every single one of you for the support that you give just by listening to the podcast and commenting on it and that sort of thing. And many, many people have also been incredibly generous in their financial support of the podcast through Buy Me a Coffee and Patreon. And for every single person who has ever used either of those mediums, thank you so much, especially to our two newest supporters, were Michael Gould and Gary Beckwith. And as a podcaster, any form of financial support is really a privilege and not a right. And the support that we get through these platforms, it helps towards cover the cost of producing and hosting the podcast. And it's also enabled me to upgrade the equipment from the podcast, from the cheap and nasty stuff that we began with, to the Rolls Royce of microphones that I'm now using to record all the episodes on. One of the things that's obvious is that support for a podcast, I think, can take many forms. And for me, what I think I probably find the most rewarding is this remarkable community of like-minded people that the podcast has allowed me to become connected to. And while Twitter, and I will always refer to it as Twitter, none of this X nonsense, has many faults, I think what it's done is it's opened a whole subculture of passionate and enthusiastic World War I fanatics. And it's lovely to be able to connect with these people. And one of the things that I certainly never expected when I began the podcast was that I've actually made some very, very good friends with some of the podcast listeners. I've drunk beer with many of the podcast listeners, both in France and in the UK. I've met and walked the battlefields with some of the podcast listeners. And I hope really that the podcast might perhaps have inspired people with maybe only a fleeting interest in the Great War to look into and discover things that maybe they haven't thought about before. I've always been incredibly astounded, I think, by the generosity of the Great War community, not necessarily just in material terms, but just in the willingness to share information and help look things up and answer questions and that kind of thing. But I really am hugely privileged to have received many lovely gifts from podcast listeners since we've begun. And some of these include a large collection of books. I was given a stunning bottle of claret by somebody, which is still under my stairs and will be at Joyed at some point in the next 10 years or so. And rather bizarrely, but very generously, an antique book on cheese, which again, has nothing to do with the First World War, but it's very interesting anyway. But I think there are two quite remarkable items which have come into my possession that would never have happened if it weren't for the podcast. And both of them to me are utterly priceless. And firstly, a listener contacted me having heard the podcast and offered me a death plaque to a man who came from my old school. And secondly, I had another listener who, knowing my love of all things Artois 1915, offered me a trio of medals to one of the men who was part of the Immortals of Festubert. Of course, something that we talked about in a podcast, this was the 80 men of the Scots Guards who fell on the Festubert battlefield in what's one of the great sort of mysteries of the First World War. And it's just, say, quite remarkable that the podcast has opened these doors. And just thanks really to everybody from the bottom of my heart, to every single one of you really who has listened or emailed or tweeted, supported and donated towards making the podcast what it is today. And I'm very, very proud of Footsteps of the Fallen, and I hope in some small way that this catalogue of podcasts has contributed something tangible to the library of First World War research that's now available for people. And the podcast will continue. We will be back for season 7, and that episode, the first episode of season 7, will be released on Sunday, the 28th of April. So anyway, it's probably more than enough self-aggrandizement and self-congratulation. It's about time that we talked about some World War One history, which of course is why you are here. So where are we in today's journey through the footsteps of the fallen? Well, we're finishing this series with a visit to some of the smaller and lesser known out-of-the-way cemeteries that are to be found over to the west of Ypres. By contrast, we're actually starting at Essex Farm, which could never be described as a small or unknown or little visited cemetery. But our journey is going to take us from Essex Farm across towards Boozinger and Elverdinger and visit, say, some of the small kind of out-of-the-way cemeteries. The cemetery at Essex Farm, which is somewhere that we've visited previously in this podcast series, is understandably most connected with the Canadian poet John McCrae. And the cemetery itself stands to the northwest of Ypres, on the road that runs from Ypres up towards Boozinger. It runs parallel to the Ypres to Isère canal. And as one comes to the cemetery, outside the cemetery, one finds what's called an Albertina Memorial. And this is they're a sort of square diamond-shaped memorial which has been placed at various locations around Flanders, and they commemorate various deeds or actions or people. And there is one outside the cemetery, say, to John McCrae. And it's actually quite unusual, the one that stands outside the cemetery, because it bears the symbol of a poppy as opposed to the royal cipher, which is what one normally finds on the Albertina memorials themselves. The cemetery is famous for the concrete dugouts that stand on the left-hand side of the cemetery itself. And between 1915 and 1917, these buildings were used as a dressing station. And as you go through the cemetery and up the canal bank, which runs along the rear wall of the cemetery, what sees surmounting the canal bank is a memorial to the 49th Division. This was the West Riding Division, of whom we will talk more in due course. And behind where the cemetery stands on the towpath was the site of one of the bridges that went over the canal. It was known as Bridge 4. It was a particularly sort of perilous place to be, and it's a bridge that features in a lot of battalion memoirs and regimental and divisional histories, and they're talking about this, the fighting that took place on this part of the battlefield. But as I said, the cemetery is always going to be associated with John McCrae. Now, he was a Canadian medical officer. He had served in the military for some time. He served during the Boer War. He was part of the artillery, and it was events that took place at Essex Farm that led McCrae to write what is arguably the most famous poem ever written during or about the First World War, called In Flanders Fields. And he wrote it whilst he was serving in the area around Essex Farm. And the dugouts that the medical personnel were using at the time of the fighting were not these concrete structures. They were simple sort of earth dugouts with planks and stuff piled over the top of them. And it was being used as a dressing station. This was in the spring of 1915. And on the 24th of April, McCrae wrote a letter home, and this was to say around the time of the first German gas attack, where the Germans used poison gas for the first time. And he said, so the letter that McCrae wrote home was quite remarkable in its sort of descriptions of what he saw, and he recounted in sort of graphic detail the sight of gas poisoned French soldiers and the stream of sort of refugees that were making their way back from villages that were up near the front. And he said that it was quite remarkable, of course, because what happened when the Germans released the gas is it did blow this enormous gaping hole in the Allied lines. And it's one of the great mysteries, so I suppose, as why the Germans didn't kind of exploit this, because they had the opportunity to kind of blow the British lines wide open. But he said that it was quite he didn't understand why they hadn't exploited it. But the Canadians paid a particularly heavy price during the fighting that took place in the aftermath of the gas attack, and by the 25th of April, the Canadians had lost 6,000 men out of the 10,000 that were in this part of the salient. And the shelling, I say, particularly in this part of the salient, was sort of unrelenting. 24 hours a day, the lines were being shelled. And because of this, the amount of casualties that were being buried in the cemetery that was attached to the dressing station sort of grew kind of every single day. And on the 2nd of May, John McCrae was treating a patient. It was a man by the name of Lieutenant Alexis Helmer. Now, he was actually a friend of McCrae's. He was obviously his patient, but they were friends together outside of the kind of the medical experience. And Helmer was effectively blown to pieces when he was hit by, I think it was an 8-inch or so, a very big shell, and he was sort of kind of atomized, really. And McCrae, after his death, read his diary, Helmer's diary, and he was very moved, I think, by the final entry, which simply says, "It has quieted a little, and I shall try to get a good sleep." And when Helmer was buried, McCrae actually said the committal. A simple wooden cross was put over Helmer's grave, and it's the site of this, it's alleged, moved McCrae to pen what has probably become the most famous poem of the First World War, "In Flanders Fields." "In Flanders Fields the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard among the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch, be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields." The poem itself was published in the magazine Punch, and it was a huge success. It became a global kind of phenomenon, really. And a lady who worked for the YMCA in America, a lady by the name of Moira Michael, she wrote a poem in response to it. The poem was called "We Shall Keep the Faith." And what it did was it kind of put this exhortation out to people to wear a poppy in honor of the dead. And what happened was that the French secretary of the YMCA, who was a lady called Madame Guerin, had the idea to sell artificial popperies to raise funds for soldiers and their families. And it was really as a result of this that the symbol of the poppy was adopted by Earl Haig, as he was then, and the newly formed British Legion, to represent remembrance of those who gave their lives in the Great War. And the first Poppy Day was actually held on the 11th of November 1921. And of course, the poppy to this day remains, I think, the eternal symbol of remembrance for all of those, not just for those who've died in the First World War, but all conflicts since. And what of Helmer? Well, unfortunately, his grave was destroyed during later fighting, and he is commemorated on the Menin Gate Memorial to the Missing. Aside from the connection with John McCrae, one of the main reasons that people seem to visit Essex Farm is the grave of Valentine Strudwick. Now, he was a young man who was only 15 years and 11 months old when he died. He came from Dorking in Surrey, and he was born on Valentine's Day in 1900 and was named Valentine, even though he was known by his family as Joe. And his father was a gardener, and his mother ran or worked as a laundress, laundering clothes for people. And he went to school, and after he left school, he went to work for his uncle, who was a coal merchant and a sort of very tough manual labour. And he actually enlisted into the army in January 1915. And like so many young men of his generation, he lied about his age. At the time when he enlisted, he was actually only 14 and claimed that he was living in Croydon. And there is a very famous Punch cartoon, which I rather like. I'm quite a big fan of Punch cartoons. I think they're rather splendid. And the one that I always springs to mind when I read about underage soldiers is the cartoon of a small boy dressed in school uniform. He's clearly very, very young indeed, wearing a school blazer and a pair of shorts with a sort of cap, a school cap at this kind of jaunty angle on his head. And the caption says, the sergeant, this is a big, burly, ferocious-looking recruiting sergeant behind the desk, is saying to the young boy, he said, "So you're 18, are you?" To which the boy replies, "Yes, absolutely." And the sergeant then says, "Do you know what happens to young boys who tell lies about their age?" To which the boy replies, "Yes, sir, they get sent to the front line." It's rather splendid. And they say this, there were so many young men who lied about their ages to be part of this. And Strudwick was actually enlisted into the 8th Battalion of the Rifle Brigade. This was known as the Prince Consort's Own. And his number was 5750. And he arrived in France on the 12th of August 1915. And he was to lose his life on the 14th of January 1916. And he was not even 16 years old at the time that he lost his life. And it really is just such a tragic waste. But what I find really interesting about Strudwick is when you look at how his death was reported. And there is an article that appeared in the Dorking and Leatherhead Advertiser. This is on the 22nd of January. And it's really interesting. And I think it's sort of reflective of the times, because what the article did is, instead of questioning the morality of killing a 15-year-old boy, it sort of used him as an example, I suppose, in a way to kind of shame older, reluctant men into joining up. And it's also something I said that reflects is that the manner of death is always reported as being instantaneous and painless. And of course, I think this was done to reassure not only family members, but also the members of the public as well, that a man didn't suffer. And as we have seen in previous podcasts, that the rather banal phrase "died of wounds" is something of a misnomer in many cases. But as I say, this idea that all death was instantaneous and the victim didn't feel a thing clearly was done, as I say, to give a sense of relief to the family. But the article reads as follows: "Another Dorking lad has achieved honour by laying down his life for his country. Private Valentine Joe Strudwick of the 8th Rifle Brigade joined up 12 months ago last January, and at the time of his death, on January the 14th, he had not reached his 16th birthday, he having been born on St. Valentine's Day 1900. His mother would naturally have liked to have kept him out of the army for at least a year or two, but young Strudwick would not have it. A fine example to those of maturer years who have not yet joined, and perhaps a reproach. With only 6 weeks' training, the lad was sent over to France. Within a short time, he lost two of his chums who were standing next to him, both instantaneously killed. The shock was such, with the addition of being badly gassed, that he was sent home and was for 3 months in hospital at Sheerness. On recovering, he rejoined his regiment in France, and this week his mother received the following letter from his commanding officer, dated January the 15th. I am very sad indeed to have to inform you that your son was killed by a shell on January the 14th. His death was quite instantaneous and painless, and his body was carried by his comrades to a little cemetery behind the lines, where it was reverently buried this morning. A cross is being made and will shortly be erected on his grave. Rifleman Strudwick had earned the goodwill and respect of his comrades and officers, and we are very sorry indeed to lose so good a soldier. On their behalf, as well as my own, I offer you my sincere sympathy. The deceased was Mrs. Strudwick's second surviving son, and her grief is the greater because of the fact that she had not been able to see him since he joined the army. She has another son in the Royal Field Artillery." Just down from where Strudwick is buried is the grave of 21-year-old Thomas Barrett. Now, he was a private in the 7th Battalion of the South Staffordshire Regiment, and he was killed on the 27th of June 1917. But it was the action that was to cost him his life that saw Barrett awarded a Victoria Cross. And I had the real privilege, actually, of meeting a relative of Thomas Barrett's on the battlefield. And it was a very emotional experience to be with her in Essex Farm at the grave of her relative. And Barrett's citation for his Victoria Cross reads as follows. For most conspicuous bravery, when a scout to a patrol, he worked his way towards the enemy line with the greatest gallantry and determination, in spite of continuous fire from hostile snipers at close range. These snipers he stalked and killed. Later, his patrol was similarly held up, and again he disposed of snipers. When during the subsequent withdrawal of the patrol, it was observed that a party of the enemy were endeavouring to outflank them, Private Barrett at once volunteered to cover the retirement, and this he succeeded in accomplishing. His accurate shooting caused many casualties to the enemy and prevented their advance. Throughout the enterprise, he was under very heavy machine gun and rifle fire, and his splendid example of coolness and daring was all beyond praise. After safely regaining our lines, this very gallant soldier was killed by a shell. As one leaves the cemetery and heads up the road towards Boosinger, on the left-hand side, you see one of the familiar green Commonwealth signs, which points you down a track across fields to a Commonwealth cemetery. And this is one of my favourite places to visit on the Ypres battlefields. It's the cemetery of Tallana Farm, and it's one of a number of Commonwealth cemeteries who owe their name to the military history of the campaign in South Africa. Of course, Tallana being a reference to the Battle of Tallana Hill that was fought in 1890 during the Boer War. And the cemetery itself originally was used by the French army, because of course this was at the beginning of the war, this was a French sector of the line, and the first burials that were made in the cemetery were made by Zouaves. Now, these were French colonial troops who came from North Africa, Algeria and Morocco and places like that, from French colonies in North Africa, and so they held this part of the line. And in the spring of 1915, it was taken over by the British, and the first British burials that were made in the cemetery were made by men of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, and they were men who were killed on the 8th and 9th of June 1915. It's an unusual cemetery because one has the sort of traditional layout of uniform rows of headstones, but it's kind of interspersed with these kind of random headstones that are sort of out of place with random sort of gaps between them. And I don't quite understand the methodology that was used for this, or whether these are original battlefield burials or men, I don't know. But it's quite unusual, say, to see these sort of these gaps in what's otherwise a standard sort of uniformity, as one has come to expect from Commonwealth cemeteries. As one comes into the cemetery in plot one, one comes across a number of special memorials, and these were headstones that were placed to denote that the person commemorated on the headstone was known or believed to be buried in the cemetery. But what often happened was that cemeteries were hit by artillery fire, and it was difficult to keep track of exactly where a body may have been placed, because of course bodies were unearthed and cemeteries were damaged and in some cases destroyed. So special memorials were erected, which is a standard Commonwealth headstone, but at the top of the headstone it bears the words "known or believed to be buried in the cemetery." And in the cemetery at Tallana Farm, on the right hand side in plot one, there are special memorials to 10 men who were part of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, and they all died on the 6th of July 1915. And this is a date that appears very regularly on headstones throughout the cemetery. And the reason for this is we will come to in due course. So the cemetery itself contains 553 burials, and 84 of the headstones in the cemetery bear the date of the 6th of July 1915. And it's a cemetery that's very much reflective of the divisions and battalions that held this part of the line. When one goes into plot three of the cemetery, it contains many, many men of the 49th Division. This was the West Riding Division, who we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, whose memorial stands on the canal bank at Essex Farm Cemetery. And they were a territorial battalion territorial division, rather, and they came into this sector of the battlefield in early 1915. And the 49th Division had the dubious distinction of being in company with the 6th Division when they were victims of a new and particularly lethal German weapon of war, because it was these two divisions that took the brunt of the first German use of phosgene gas. And after the first gas attacks had taken place in April 1915, the science and the technology behind the development of chemical weapons increased dramatically. And to say the Germans developed further examples of poison gas from the chlorine that they first used, and phosgene was the sort of the first iteration of this. And it's a brutally horrible weapon of war. What it does, I'm not a chemist, but I think my understanding of it is that when you breathe it in, what it does is it turns the liquid, the water that naturally occurs in someone's lungs, it turns it into hydrochloric acid, and this burns the inside of the lung and you effectively drown on your own blood. I mean, utterly horrific. And I say it was the men of the 49th and the 6th Divisions who were in the firing line, as it were, when the Germans first used phosgene gas in the winter of 1915. As one walks around plot 2 of the cemetery, we mentioned this date, the 6th of July 1915, and plot 2 contains many, many men whose date of death is shown as the 6th of July. So what happened? Well, what occurred to see so many casualties was a diversionary attack that took place about a mile to the northeast of here, just outside Businger, where an attack was launched against a German strongpoint, a main German trench that was called International Trench. Now, this ran on the east of the canal and was to the west of a road that ran across this part of the battlefield. At the time, it was known as Huddleston Road. And it was a really, as I say, it was a diversionary attack, because what the British were planning was that they were going to launch an attack at Hooge down to the east of Ypres. And what they wanted to do was try and sort of divert German reserves away. And in the end, what happens, the attack at Hooge was actually cancelled, but the attack against International Trench was ordered to carry on. And the attack itself began by a bombardment of British and French artillery against the German positions. And what the engineers had done, quite remarkably, is they'd floated an 18-pound field gun over the canal on a raft, and they'd taken it up to the front line where they'd built this specially constructed gun pit for the gun. And they were effectively firing this 18-pound gun at almost kind of point blank range. This was a part of the battlefield where the British and German trenches were incredibly close together, in some places no more than sort of 30 metres apart. And there are records, when you look through some of battalion war diaries and personal memoirs of men who served here, about men who actually had conversations with German soldiers in the trenches. They were so close that they could hear each other and they could talk to each other. And there were many, many men in the German army who were English speakers, and like there are many records of conversations being had. But it was an area, say, of the battlefield where trenches were incredibly, incredibly close together. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, men of the 1st Battalion, the Rifle Brigade, and the 1st Somerset Light Infantry, they left their trenches and launched an attack against International Trench. And initially it started very well. They were quite successful. They managed to get into the trench and hold the trench, but it was the scene of some really brutal fighting. This was fighting with grenades and bayonets and sort of hand-to-hand fighting. And they managed to capture about 400 metres of the German line. But at 6:30, so half an hour after the attack began, the German artillery opened fire. And what they did is they actually managed to destroy all of the bridges that ran over the canal at Businger. And what happened was that the Royal Engineers were in this battle to try and construct these temporary bridges, almost like pontoon bridges across the canal, because what this meant was that the men of the Rifle Brigade and the Somerset Light Infantry, whilst they had successfully captured the trench, it was impossible to get reserves up to sort of reinforce them and try and help them. They found themselves in a very sort of precarious situation. And what they were doing is they were kind of desperately digging in and were trying to reconnect back to the British front line. And after a couple of hours digging, of course, this battlefield was under constant shell and machine gun fire. They'd managed to dig a trench that was about a metre deep, but this was quite kind of insufficient. And the Royal Engineers who were back on the canal were desperately trying to rig up some form of temporary structure across the bridge, which eventually they did manage to do. And the bridges that they rigged up were known as 6E and 6F. And what happened was that once the canal had been covered, men of the Hampshire Regiment managed to come up and support the Rifle Brigade and the Somerset Light Infantry and kind of reinforce the lines. And just as the Hampshires were coming up, the Germans launched kind of like the mother of all bombardments, and they landed shells with great accuracy on the British lines and no man's land as well. And an awful lot of casualties. And this was, as always, a precursor to a German counterattack, which duly came, but miraculously the men managed to beat the attack off. And this process of attack and counterattack was to go on really for the next 4 days. And eventually what happened was that the Germans decided that it was futile to kind of hold what remained of International Trench, and they pulled back to a strong point, which is slightly to the north, that was called Farm 14. And at the end of the fighting, which rather euphemistically was described as a small but very successful operation, the British had actually managed to gain about 100 metres of territory, and they held about 300 metres of what had been the German trench. But this operation had cost the lives of 366 men who were killed on this part of the battlefield. And one of the reasons I think I have a connection with Tolarna Farm is I actually have the death plaque of a man who died on the fighting here. He was a man of the Hampshire Regiment called William Banfield. And if you would like to hear more about him and how I came to acquire his death plaque, please have a look through the back catalogue of the podcast for the episode called The Teaspoon of Tolarna. And it will tell you all about what happened and, as I say, how I came to acquire this death plaque. Tolarna Farm is the only cemetery that I've been in when I've been guiding somebody around the battlefields where I've really been lost for words. I was guiding somebody around, and we visited the cemetery, and it was a very nice, warm, hot, sunny day, and we were slightly disturbed to find a young Belgian couple in the throes of passion in delecto flagrante on the ground behind the cross of sacrifice, and in true British fashion kept a stiff upper lip and pretended that nothing was going on. But it's not something that I've ever seen happening in a war cemetery before. And to be honest, it's not something I'm in a particular hurry to see again. As one heads west towards the small town of Elverdinge, one comes across a cemetery called Bluay Farm Cemetery. And this is one of these lovely, small, off-the-beaten-track cemeteries that litter this part of the battlefields. The cemetery itself is located in an area that was behind the lines, but it was a real hive of activity during the war. It was a sort of central point for communication trenches that led up to the front lines, and a real sort of hive of activity. And it contains 450 graves. It's split up into two plots, and it's quite interesting when one goes around that the almost a quarter of the men who are buried in the cemetery are men members of the artillery. And of course, this part of the line could be shelled by the Germans with the artillery on the Pilkem Ridge just to the east of Boozinger. And I think perhaps there's a thought, well, if you were behind the lines, it was a relatively sort of safe place to be. And I think this proves the point that it clearly it wasn't. But the farm itself was used as a dressing station before the battle, the third battle of Ypres. And the vast majority of the men who are buried in the cemetery died between July and December 1917, of course, the third battle of Ypres itself. And the first grave that I noticed, I have a particular interest in names, and I think the First World War is a conflict that the names are very much of a generation. There's some really rather splendid names that one finds. And I came across a grave in Plot 1 of a man in the Royal Artillery who was a gunner by the name of George Harrison. And this was pointed out to me by somebody, because the chap who pointed out was a massive fan of the Beatles. And of course, he found it quite amusing to spot somebody with the name of George Harrison. And Harrison was actually killed in August 1917. There were a number of gunners who share the same date of death, and one can only imagine they were probably hit by German shellfire. But as part of the sort of looking at this name, a bit of research that I did was into it, and I discovered that actually there is buried on the Western Front, there is a Captain John Lennon who is buried on the Somme, and there is a Private Paul McCartney who is buried in Brandhurst Cemetery in Ypres. But unsurprisingly, perhaps, there is no Ringo Starr buried anywhere who lost their life during the First World War. But one of the things that's interesting about the cemetery is it contains a very, very unusual headstone. It's a very unusual regiment, and it's the grave of a man by the name of Corporal Eatwell. Now, he was a member of the South African Railway Overseas Dominion Service, and this branch of the South African Army had only 19 men were killed in the whole of the First World War. And quite surprisingly, three of them are actually buried in this cemetery. And it turns out that the three who were buried here, they were hit by a shell whilst they were working on railway construction behind the lines. And they were all killed. And it's nice in a way that they were sort of brothers in life and now lie buried next to their mates, united once again in death. I also came across the grave of a balloon officer. This was a member of the Royal Flying Corps by the name of Second Lieutenant Blacksby. Now, he was killed on the 21st of February 1918. And the balloon was a bizarre and, I think, very unpleasant sort of place to be, a part of a weapon of war. And balloons were used in huge quantities along the Western Front. There were three types of balloon that were deployed for use in warfare. There was free balloons, captive balloons, and what were called large dirigibles. And while free and captive balloons have been used for a long time, dirigibles, which basically means that balloons that were maneuverable, so effectively kind of airships, really came to the fore during the First World War. And they went to altitudes of sort of anywhere between sort of 1200 to 1800 meters above the front line. And they really were used for observation. They're kind of like reconnaissance missions, because from that sort of height, balloon observers could see the movements of enemies, and they were kind of out of the range of ground fire. But it was a very, very dangerous occupation. And free balloons, as the name sort of implies, were able to move freely with the wind, and they really couldn't be very controlled, and they really weren't very reliable for surveillance. And they were generally used for a sort of vehicle, I suppose we would almost say like kind of vehicles for propaganda. And they were certainly used by the Allies to scatter leaflets over enemy lines. There's reports of this happening at Verdun, and also along the Saint-Mihiel salient over in the east of France. And there's a record of a member of the American Balloon Service, a man by the name of Captain Blankenhorn, who said that there is no doubt whatever that next to the aeroplane, the free balloon is the best medium of distribution. But the most commonly used type of balloon was what was called a captive balloon. And these performed, I think really it's really easy to describe, very much like a giant kite. And they were tethered to a winch and had they were on a vehicle that had a sort of huge spool of cable attached to the back, and they flowed sort of fairly steadily with the wind, but generally in the sort of the preferred direction of the person who was on the ground. And they had an average range of visibility of some in the region of about 9 miles or so. But obviously, if you were up there with binoculars, you could see perhaps up to maybe sort of 10, 11 miles. And ideally, the aim really was to sort of maneuver balloons around about sort of 6 miles up the front line. But in reality, I think the kind of the displacement of these balloons obviously was very much dependent on friendly and enemy artillery. And it was as part of a captive balloon that this officer was to lose his life. And what happened later on in the war was that they became obviously great targets for German aircraft. And of course, the vast majority of the crews in there didn't have parachutes. So if you were caught by an aircraft, you were pretty much doomed. And it seems quite likely that that's what happened to Second Lieutenant Blaxby. But I was looking through when I was doing the research into balloons, and I came across the history of the 15th Balloon Company. And it's a thrilling read. And if you can ever find a copy, if you are having difficulty sleeping in the evening, and have a good read of it. But it did contain a lovely passage, because what happened when companies moved around, that the balloons could actually be sort of transported with them inflated. But obviously what they had to do very carefully was survey the route that they were going, because they couldn't go under bridges or anything at all like that. And what happened was that it was generally a lot easier for the crews to kind of deflate the balloons, dismantle them, then re-inflate them. But this passage from the balloon history reads as follows. Daily, under the brisk, resounding commands of the balloon sergeant, we learned how to take a balloon from the hangar, give her daily exercise in the clouds, and return her for a night's repose. Here, we learned that a hot air balloon is more temperamental than a prima donna or a movie actress. Day and night, a guard must be kept near her chamber, with one eye on the manometer glass and another on the lookout for any careless wanderer who might sit on a pile of the gas cylinders to use to inflate the balloon to enjoy what may be their last cigarette. Our final stop on this brief tour around this part of the battlefield is the lovely cemetery of Ferme Olivier. The cemetery itself was begun on the 9th of June 1915, and it was used continuously until the 5th of August 1917. This was an area of the front that was behind the lines, and whilst it's very peaceful now, it was a real hive of activity. There were huge numbers of camps and supply depots and hospitals and casualty evacuation and casualty clearing and field ambulances and that sort of thing. And in fact, when one looks through the record, you can see that very close by to where the cemetery now lies were the dressing stations of the 62nd, 16th, 9th, 11th, 129th and 130th field ambulances, who all had their dressing stations here. And the village itself was just about within the kind of range of German artillery, and it did suffer quite a lot during the war. And one of the sort of remarkable things is that the chateau of Elverdinge actually kind of sort of survived pretty much intact. I think kind of parts of the roof came down, much of the windows went in, but miraculously, considering the artillery fire that was in this area, that it survived at all. But when one goes into the cemetery, it's really interesting, because there are contained in plot two is a two collective graves, and this contains the remains of 41 men of the 3rd Battalion of the Monmouthshire Regiment, and they were all killed by a single shell on the 29th of December 1915. And they were on parade in Elverdinge when a single shell was fired from a German naval gun, which was actually located in the Hutholst forest, and this shell unfortunately landed in the middle of where the regiment was on parade, and 41 men were killed in the explosion. I mean, it must have been if you think about a naval gun, obviously it was a very big shell, and it must have been some explosion to have killed that many men. But they say they are buried in these sort of collective graves in plot two of the cemetery. But it's an interesting cemetery to go around. It's got some interesting graves, and this is something that we've talked about an awful lot in the podcast. There are bits of every cemetery that have fascinating headstones, and every headstone has a tale to tell. And I came across one that belongs to a man called Second Lieutenant Mark Noble. Now, he was a member of the Royal Field Artillery and was killed on the 1st of July 1917. He was only 20 years old, and he was killed whilst he had gone out into no man's land to try and rescue some officers who were wounded. But what's interesting about Noble is that he was the youngest of 20 boys who in 1907 had actually attended Robert Baden-Powell's first ever scout camp, which was held on Brownsea Island, which is just located just off the coast of Dorset. And it was as a result of this camp that the entire Boy Scout movement would be created. And in fact, the last time I went to the cemetery, a Boy Scouts troop had actually left a cap and a badge down by his headstone. It's rather nice that his memory is not forgotten by this remarkable and I think very worthwhile organization. Just along from where Noble is buried is the grave of a Lieutenant Colonel. His name was George Gregor, and he was part of the Royal Field Artillery, and he lost his life on the 1st of July 1917, and when a German shell hit the officer's mess, and there are a number of casualties. And his headstone is unusual in one respect because it has his name, Lieutenant Colonel G.T. Gregor, V.D. And it's not, as somebody asked me, anything to do with an unfortunate health condition. It's quite it's actually the volunteer officer's decoration. And what this was an award that was given for long and faultless service as an officer in the volunteer force. And in 1908, it was taken over by what became known as the Territorial Decoration. And it's certainly the only headstone I've seen that has the initials V.D. on it. I'm sure there are others around, but certainly I haven't seen any of them that I can recall. Also buried in the cemetery is one of those unfortunate men who were shot at dawn. His name was Private George Watkins, and he was executed for desertion on the 15th of May 1917. And he was a reservist who had been recalled to the military at the beginning of war. He'd originally enlisted into the army in 1904. So he was probably aged somewhere around about 28, 29 or something like that when he rejoined the regiment. And he had no time for retraining. He was shipped immediately over to France, and he arrived in France on the 13th of August 1914, where he was posted to the 2nd Welsh, and he served with them at the fighting at Mons. And in 1915, he was actually wounded twice, and he was by all accounts quite an exemplary soldier. Each time he was wounded, he went back to active service relatively quickly, and he was subsequently moved into the 13th Battalion. He fought through the Battle of the Somme, and in the autumn, December of 1916, the division was moved up to Ypres, and it was in December that he went absent without leave. And he was actually absconded for a remarkable period of almost 3 months before he was finally detained. And there was a very lengthy delay between him being apprehended and his court-martial taking place. And despite the fact that he had a fine record of service, and he was clearly a very good soldier, and say he'd been wounded and had made no sort of attempt to swing the lead, as it were, and went straight back to his regiment, it was the length of time that he was absent, I think, that was really his undoing. The soldier himself at his court-martial pleaded that he was going through particular troubles at home. He had a lot of family issues and a lot of sort of family problems, and this was what led to his, as he described, his uncharacteristic behaviour. Like so many of the men who were subjected to these trials, he wasn't defended, and his protestations about issues with his family simply went unheeded, and he was put before a firing squad and is buried in the cemetery to this day. There's an interesting grave in the cemetery in Plot 3 to a man by the name of Second Lieutenant Francis Myers, MC. Now, he was a Jewish soldier, and his headstone bears the Star of David itself and seen on Jewish headstones. And he was a member of originally the South African Army Veterinary Corps, and then went into the Suffolk Regiment, and he was attached to the Royal Flying Corps, and he had been awarded his military cross for his part in a raid that he'd been in with the 11th Suffolks in October 1916, but he died on Valentine's Day, the 14th of February 1917, when he was flying with 20th Squadron of the Royal Flying Corps, and he was working as an observer, and he was up in the air in a plane that was called an FE, and this was a two-seater aircraft where the observer sat in front of the pilot, and the plane that he was in was being piloted by a man called Lieutenant F.J. Taylor, and they were attacked by German aircraft, and it's during this attack that the pilot, Lieutenant Taylor, was quite badly wounded, and it was evident that what they needed to do was get down to the ground as quickly as possible for a sort of forced landing. And what happened was that as they came down to land, Taylor was starting to become faint from his wounds, and the aircraft hit telephone wires and crashed down into the field, and Myers, unfortunately, at the age of just 20, was to lose his life. And it seems from research that the plane was shot down by a German pilot by the name of Lieutenant Pierre Strahl, who was part of Jagdstaffel 18, as their records claim that an aircraft was downed on that afternoon near Zuidschoten, which is about 2 miles to the north of where we are at the moment. But the last grave that really came of interest was that of a German soldier, which is a man by the name of Lieutenant Alexander Kutcher, who's buried in the cemetery. Now, he died on the 1st of May 1917. Now, he was a pilot with Jagdstaffel 28, and he was mortally wounded in combat over the town of Poperinge, and he was flying an Albatross D3, and he did actually manage to land his plane behind British lines, but unfortunately he was so badly wounded that he died of his injuries. And what's particularly interesting is that we actually have a record of the man who shot him down, who was a man with a Lieutenant Edwin Travis Cole, MC, and he recorded what happened. And Cole went on to call shooting down this aircraft as the finest day he'd lived so far. And in the account that he gave, he described he was fighting with 4 German aircraft, and he described in great detail the fight that he had with one of them. And he said as follows: "He had a wonderful machine and was the finest flyer I've ever been up against. We each tried to better each other from 12,000 to 800 feet. And when we got near the ground, I managed to get in some good shots, and he came down, burst into flames just before hitting the ground, and the machine went vertically into a pond. I landed in a field next to him and rushed over. Thousands of Tommies and people were watching, and a cheer went up from all of them. However, when we got the poor fellow out, the doctor found him with 5 shots through the heart, so there was no chance for him. It was all frightfully exciting. Fortunately, I did not have a single shot in my machine." I hope you've enjoyed this final episode of Season 6 with this brief tour around the battlefields around the west of Ypres. And we will be back on Sunday, the 28th of April, with our first episode of Season 7. And until then, I wish you all a very, very happy Easter. And thank you once again for your support in listening to the podcast. And I look forward to having your company again as we continue our journey walking in the footsteps of the fallen. You've been listening to an episode of Footsteps of the Fallen, the Great War podcast with me, battlefield researcher, historian and writer Matt Dixon. There are lots of ways to keep in touch with what we're up to. The first point of call is, of course, our website at footstepsofthefallen.com. You can find me on Twitter at footsteps_pod, or we're also on Instagram as footstepsblog. And if you are enjoying what you're listening to and would like to help support the podcast, there's a number of ways that you can do that. You can either support us via Patreon, where you can find us at Footsteps of the Fallen, or through Buy Me a Coffee, where you can find us as Footsteps Pod. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I will look forward to having your company in our next episode as we continue to walk through the footsteps of the fallen.